Thank you, Mr. Bricker, for advising us about technology. This wasn't true many years ago. When I gave my first sermonette, we didn't have the technology that we do today, and it is really quite remarkable. Although, I would like to tell you, you know, we've already had artificial intelligence in our house. I know that because my wife never forgets anything. And every married man understands how that works. And we do use artificial intelligence in the church in a limited basis. But what we tell, what we instruct it to do is you only look for what's information on the church website and in the church literature. Because if you just let it go, turn to the world, and you want to craft something, who knows where you're going to wind up with what 450 different sects or more of churchianity rather than the Bible and the truth. You can't just tell the Bible because then you have different translations of it. So far that's been working, and it all really started with the Google Translate, where they're translating it, and working with Mr. Kubik in the Eastern Europe area, he said, now be really careful when you use it, because, of course, he speaks Russian and Ukrainian. And he said, I was writing in English and said, greetings. And he was writing a letter, and it came out to congratulations in the original language. So there's little nuances that can be a challenge there. And incidentally, if you see the heavy bags under the eyes each Sabbath, that's because the Zoom service for the Nordic Baltic congregation, which is a virtual congregation, starts at 4:30 every Saturday morning. So if it looks like I'm ready to fall over, please give me some forgiveness here. The bags under the eyes are well earned. And if you have clues on how to help that, that would be good. Now, Mr. Scott told me how to do this. We're going to see if I'm going to pass his test on how to unblack the screen. Is it unblack? We're good? Okay. When we were young, we often heard admonitions from our parents. If it was cold or rainy, our mother might say, wear your cap or wear your gloves. Or if it was snowy or muddy weather, we might hear, wear your overshoes. Well, I grew up on a farm, and so my father would say, now there were four boys in the family, and he would tell us, check the oil on the tractor before you use it. Better check the radiator fluid, too. You see, Dad was insistent on checking the fluid levels in the tractor because failure to do so would ruin the tractor. He never worried about not filling up the tractor with gasoline. He never had to instruct us to do that because he knew full well, as I learned the hard way, when you're out on the half a mile or three quarters of a mile away on the far end of the field and you run out of gas, you get to walk home and then go back with a gallon jug with gas. And I remember cultivating corn. Oh, man, I did everything right except I forgot to fill with gas. Far end of the farm, walked back home, walked back with the jug. And, you know, I got so involved in cultivating that I turned around and kept and ran out on the other end of the field again. So I know he never had to remind us to fill up with gas, but all these other things were fair warnings because we didn't want to ruin the tractor. Dad would say, be sure to check the hydraulic fluid because that's what operates the equipment behind to raise and lower it or engage it. And another warning was, if you're pulling a piece of farm equipment, don't turn too short. If you turn too short, you can hook the piece of equipment up on the lugs of the wheel, and it'll come over and squish you. And, well, with a 20 to 30-foot drag with bars with spikes in it for ground leveling, when you're a kid and you're 10 or 12 years old pulling the tractor and you see that riding up the wheel, you become a believer in Dad's warning. Follow the warning, and now you're stuck. What are you going to do? You don't want to go home and tell Dad. You know, well, how can I possibly get out of this situation? So you follow the warnings. and a lot of that is survival instinct there. Now, I was raised around livestock. We had a dairy and a beef farm. And there were certain things. We had a few horses. And one thing we learned was you never approach a horse from the rear or a cow from the side. Because if you approach the horse from the rear, horses can kick straight back. But a cow will kick out to the side. Cows generally don't kick straight back. Well, my uncle, my dad's younger brother, as a young man, he stepped out of the horse stall. They had draft horses, yes. When I was little, they still had draft horses and tractors, like somebody else who gave a sermon out here. And the horse was named Judy, by the way. And he stepped out of the stall, and as a young man would do, he wasn't wearing a shirt, hot summer day, and the horse decided to kick back, straight back, and it left a U-shaped hoof print on his back. Had he been a couple inches forward, he wouldn't have known it. Had he been a few inches back, it would have snapped his back. So the horses can kick straight back, so you be mindful in that direction. Now, our parents did not give us these warnings because they hated us. They didn't want to do it just because they were overly controlling. They warned us because they loved us. They didn't want anything bad to happen to us. They knew that if we didn't wear the cap or the gloves or the boots in bad weather, we might get sick. They knew if we weren't careful operating the farm equipment, we could get hurt. Now, perhaps when you were a teenager and your parents gave you warnings, when they handed you the car keys, they said, be careful. And you usually said, when? And then my dad would explain the dangers of driving on snow and ice. And we've had a little bit of that this winter. I know that several years ago, we have on a trip up to Chicago, and of course, people from the south heading north to the Chicago aren't familiar with winter if they're southern vehicles. In fact, today, coming here 2 hours, we had 1 degree drop dropped 20 degrees in 2 hours. So it just kept stepping down. So I feel like I drove up from the south today. Well, we drove up to Chicago, and it was dropping 1 degree every 10 miles as we traveled north. And cars with southern plates would come zipping by us on the freeway. And I said, don't worry, we're going to see them again. And sure enough, we counted about 50 vehicles on the freeway ditch on the way going north in about a 50, 60 mile spread. We're talking trucks, we're talking cars, where they did not heed the signals, heed the warnings that were there. Well, in the Bible, we have a number of warnings that were issued by our Creator. And Jesus mentions the warnings, not because he hates us or wants to control our lives, but because he loves us. And it's just like our parents telling us to wear the cap or be careful on the highway. Jesus the Christ lists 7 specific warnings that he gave to his disciples during his 3.5-year ministry. So I'm entitling this 7 warnings from Jesus. Now, 7 times Jesus uses the word beware, basically warning in English. And it's an explanation. He told us what to beware of, what we should be careful about. And if it's important for him to mention to his disciples, it's surely critical for us to understand today what he was warning us about. So the first warning he gives is in Matthew 7:15, and it's beware of false prophets. Now, we heard this on the sermonette, which was an excellent introduction today, Matthew 7:15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. Ravenous means hungry. Well, we don't have too many wolves around our place, but I do have about a dozen sheep. Now, I have a cousin in Minnesota who raises sheep, had a livestock farm, and he's got a few sheep as a hobby. He's got a bumper sticker on his pickup truck. It says, eat lamb, big letters. And the little letters underneath of that, 3 million coyote can't be wrong. Well, they are hungry. Coyotes like wolves. They like lamb, like some of us do. And so Jesus is telling us, be careful for the deception. Be careful for the ones in sheep's clothing. They're disguised as a sheep, but they're really hungry wolves. If we take a look at Matthew 24 and verse 11, we will read, many false prophets shall arise and deceive many. So there's going to be many false prophets, and who will they deceive? Not just a few, but many. Many is a lot. Doesn't give us an exact number, but they're telling us this is going to happen. We can read in Acts 13 in the first 12 verses, Paul and Barnabas encountered a false prophet. This was open. We were given that example. In Revelation 19, verse 20, we read, what does a false prophet do? They deceive others. Well, when Jesus was speaking to his disciples, he said in Matthew 24:24, if possible, they will deceive the very elect. Well, who do you suppose he was talking to? He was talking to his disciples. Who do you suppose the very elect were? Those were the ones right around him. In other words, it's possible for you, disciple, that you could be deceived. They could be seduced by slander or libel. Slander is false spoken statements. Libel is false written statements. And false statements or slander that appears to be true. And in this modern environment, we have the capacity with electronics to spread lies very quickly. I can't remember who it was that said it. Maybe it was Mark Twain, I'm not sure, that said, lies can travel around the world while the truth is still putting its shoes on. In other words, they travel quick. They're very delicious that when you hear something like that. So we are to have our antenna up to be aware of the possibility of false prophets. Because who could be deceived? The disciples of Jesus. And if we claim to be his disciples, that means it's if it were possible, even the very elect. So it's our job to make sure it's not going to be possible. We have to take those steps. So the first warning is to beware of false prophets. The second warning that we're given, and this one I puzzled at, is beware of men. Oh man, there's men in this room, there's men out on the street, there's men everywhere. What was he speaking to in this case? In Matthew 10, verse 17, beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils and scourge you in the synagogues. Well, that's very uncomfortable. Are you supposed to be suspicious of everybody everywhere all the time that they'll turn on you? So if we take a look then, what does that mean? In Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 14, the Apostle Paul wrote to the congregation in Ephesus, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. In other words, there's a structure or a form where people can help other people within the church. And it goes on, if we read, continuing on in verse 13, verse 14, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine. Ooh, ever been on a sailboat? Strong waves, or seen it, and it's bouncing around? Now, I've been on a few ferry boats and a few ships, and they're rocking, okay? And they get tossed about when the seas are rough. And it's saying here that to not be tossed about by every wind of doctrine. One of the more dramatic instances I had was I went to the feast in Squaw Valley, California. This is before a number of you were born. And Lake Tahoe was about 5 miles wide and about 12 miles long. Big lake, very clear lake. You can see big boulders at the bottom. And a buddy of mine, we rented a canoe. We were going to canoe across the lake because it was an adventure. You could go from the California side to the Nevada side and canoe back. So we rented a canoe, took off that afternoon, and it was a calm, beautiful day. And we paddled across this five-mile lake, and it was great. And we spent about an hour running around in Nevada, and we got time to go back. Now the wind picked up from the west, the direction we came from. And now there were white caps, and we had this little canoe. And our rental car was way back on the other side of the lake, and we got this canoe. Well, we'll give it a try. We're young and dumb. We can try this. And I was at least wearing a T-shirt. My buddy was shirtless, and he just had shorts, and we just had sneakers on. We had one life preserver between the two of us, and we said, well, just to be safe, we'll put the car keys on the life preserver. They'll be able to identify who it was that used to be there. And we went across that lake, paddling back, thinking, I don't know if we're going to make it. Now, I was riding in the bow in the front and paddling hard, and the waves would come up and splash hard. Well, we were tossed about by the wind and the waves, as it says here, tossed to and fro. Wasn't the trickery of men that was doing it. It was our own foolishness in not looking at a weather forecast. And we made it halfway back until some of you are familiar with the geography to Calneva Point, where the state line for California and Nevada come together in big rocks and boulders and cliffs. And we said, let's make it for the nearest piece of land that we can get to survive. And then the waves are so big and they would come down, and there were rocks, boulders the size of a room. So it would go up and then come down. Oh, no, we're going to crash on one of those. We steered between the boulders, the huge room-sized boulders, came to a cliff, and it was wonderful. There was a stairs, wooden stairs somebody had built. Now, it was very steep, very steep. Well, we're going to be responsible. So the two of us made it to the stairs, and we hauled this canoe up this steep cliff there, and that's when we heard the dogs. We were on a private estate, which was a fenced place, and they had guard dogs. And life was going to be hard, we could tell. You know, after paddling that hard, you have no idea how fast and hard you can run for the gate. And we made it. Hitchhiked back several miles back to get the car. Then we rehearsed how to get the canoe into a little Chevy, whether it was a Nova or something, a little car. So we said, we'll just stick the canoe in the trunk, leave it open, and it'll stick out. We'll wedge it in, and we'll drive back a few miles. Hopefully, we won't get a ticket. But what about the dogs? So we rehearsed. How many seconds could we do this? Got back in the gate, drove lickety-split to where we had dropped off the canoe, and we were counting the seconds, managed to jam it in, jump out of the car, get in, and the dogs didn't quite get us before we left. So when I read this, this brings this picture to mind. Tossed about by every wind of doctrine. It wasn't safe for us to do what we were doing. We weren't paying attention. It says like children. Okay, we were 22 and 23. Okay. But being careful here about the truth. And it says being tossed about by every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men. Can you believe people would actually try to trick you into something? Some of them know better, and some of them don't want to know better. And so they willingly believe a lie. It continues on in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. So how can they gather a following to themselves to make themselves look important? Like they were, as it says up in verse 11, if they were an apostle or a prophet or an evangelist or a pastor or a teacher, they want to put themselves in that position so they will mislead other people. Paul wrote to the church and continued to write to the Ephesians in chapter 5 and verse 6. In Ephesians 5 and verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Empty words, meaning they're not fruitful, they're not productive, they're unhelpful. They are not good for you, and he calls these, Paul calls them, that God will be angry with the sons of disobedience, the ones who don't follow God's law. Paul also wrote in Colossians to the church in Colossae in chapter 2 and verse 8, beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. And what do we see around us in the world today, and much of churchianity? And I will use the term churchianity because you can't really call it Christianity, because what did Christ say? If you love me, keep my commandments. And they're disposing of the commandments, so they're creating their own traditions. And so what are they doing? According to the tradition of men in their philosophy and vain deceit, and not according to Christ. So that was Paul's warning. Now, and of course, we would say, well, we would never, you know, follow such nonsense, those kind of words. Well, it was many years ago. I had a small company. We had a dozen employees. And as you might imagine, in a small company, we had a dozen employees. We're all close-knit. We knew each other well. And every Friday, before I locked up, wished everybody a good weekend and hoped that they all do. And we joked around and kidded. And one Friday, it was just a fluke when I said, "Well, I'll see everybody on Monday. Don't get hit by a train." Now, it was just a lighthearted comment. Didn't mean anything of it. After all, everybody looks for trains, right? Following Monday, I received a phone call from an employee who wouldn't be coming to work that day. Over the weekend, the young lady and a group of friends were riding in a large RV motorhome, and the RV was approaching a railroad crossing, and the warning lights were flashing. It didn't have a bar coming down. And the driver thought he could make it across the tracks before the train came. And he was right. He made it across the tracks. However, he did not account for the trailer and the boat that he was pulling. And the train hit right between the motorhome and the boat. Well, what happened then? The train, of course, couldn't stop. You know, they don't have brakes. Like, it takes a half mile or a mile to stop, depending how fast they're going. It slammed the motorhome on one side of the train and the boat and trailer on the other side of the train and then dragged them along. Well, the motorhome had a propane tank on it. The impact had it caused an explosion, blew apart the motorhome. And the young lady that worked for me, she was about 30, and she said, "I thought everything was fine, and then I woke up in a field. There was no motorhome. It had disintegrated. Now, there was a little child that died. Another girl lost her leg. She was just bruised up, lying in a grass field, and made it." You see, the train engineer couldn't respond quick enough to avoid that particular crash. And it's all because the driver didn't heed the warning. Now, he didn't plan carefully ahead. And the young lady that worked for me, she wasn't deceived by words. She was deceived by actions, somebody else's actions. She put her trust in somebody that she should have been more careful about, because the consequences can be fatal. It's like this in all of life. It isn't just the people's words. It's what their actions are that can get us into trouble. So when we read Jesus' warning, "Beware of men," it really isn't whether or not they mean to do harm, okay? Because they may not deliberately mean it, but the results would be the same as if they did. So, number two, beware of men. The third warning is beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We read Matthew 16 and verse 6. Jesus said to them, "Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And again, who's he speaking to? His disciples. Now, he's describing leaven. Of course, we know leaven is something that's like yeast that puffs up. And when he's speaking here, he's not referring to he's not referring to bread per se. He's reusing that as an analogy, because if we read in Matthew 16:11, just a few verses down the road, "How is it that you don't understand that I don't speak to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees?" It's not bread. It's what they are doing that they will be puffed up. They will be, and what puffs up, of course, during the week of unleavened bread, it puffs up with sin. Things that are in violation of God's law, things that replace the truth. So Jesus is saying, beware of the leaven. Once that gets into your life and you start following things that the Pharisees and the Sadducees do, well, what kind of leaven is he talking about? We can go to Luke 12 and verse 1. And if we look on the last part of that verse, Jesus describes the leaven of the Pharisees. He said, "Beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." Well, what's hypocrisy? Who wants to be called a hypocrite, right? Doesn't sound like a compliment. Hypocrisy, according to Merriam-Webster Dictionary, a feigning or faking, to be what one is not, or to believe what one does not, like the false assumption of an appearance of virtue or religion. In other words, saying one thing but doing another. The world is full of hypocrisy. As a practical matter, we're all hypocrites. How awkward and embarrassing that is, because we all want to do well, but we don't always do as well as we want to. We should minimize that. But the Pharisees here and the Sadducees, they're apparently very open about it. They would say, do this, but then they wouldn't do those things themselves and do it with the right heart. So we have to beware of that which would, the sin that would puff us up, which is the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So that's the third warning that Jesus gave us. The fourth warning that Jesus gave us, beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees in Matthew 16, verse 12. Then understood they that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Well, so we want to be careful of the hypocrisy, but then what are they teaching? It's false doctrine. He doesn't say beware of the doctrine established by God. He says beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. They were creating a belief system. If we turn to Mark, the book of Mark in chapter 7 and verse 7, in Mark 7, verse 7, Jesus said, in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. We're looking at people that make stuff up as they go along and pretending it comes from God, the commandments of men, and then they teach them as if they really were doctrines. Some years ago, we had a gal whose father died in the congregation. He went to a church, a Protestant church, that did not believe in using musical piano or musical instruments in their service. You may know of what denomination I'm speaking of. And so everybody would sing a cappella. I hadn't any experience with that, but I went to the funeral out of courtesy for the gal that was in church, and I experienced it firsthand. They were teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. They read some verse in Psalm somewhere about something that they interpreted that you shouldn't use musical instruments in church, and yet they somehow overlooked that the Psalms, many of written by David, who commissioned like 400 musicians to serve in the temple and were paid to do so. They were important part of the gospel, of the of a church service. So beware of teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. In Colossians 2 and verse 8, we continue this doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. In Colossians 2:8, beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. So they'll come up with their answer, they'll come up with their explanation, but it's not according to the Holy Scriptures. And he goes on, and really it's quite a read in Colossians 2, and we read on through the chapter, and I put this in English in an NIV. It says, why, Colossians 2, verse 20, you've died with Christ, meaning your old life, and have become dead to the old ways. Why do you follow the old ways of worship? Why do you obey man-made rules? Verse 21, the rules say, you must not put your hand on this. Do not put this in your mouth. You must not put your finger on that. In other words, the Pharisees and Sadducees were making stuff up and saying, here's all these things that you must do, as if God had told them to do so. Verse 22, all these things come to an end when they are used. You're only following man-made rules. Verse 23, it looks as if it's wise to follow these rules in an act of worship because they're hard on the body. Ooh, so if it's hard to do, it must be good for you, right? Well, or not. It looks as if they are done without pride, but they are worth doing. They do not take away a man's desire to sin. You know, the warnings about following the doctrine of the Sadducees and Pharisees I thought of this example. In the winter, in the northern states, it gets cold enough for ponds and lakes to freeze over, and it forms a layer of ice on top of the pond or the lake. And there might be a sign that says, warning, thin ice. In other words, when the temperature's changing in the fall or the spring, and the radio announcer will issue the warning, don't attempt to walk on a frozen pond or a frozen lake, because looks can be deceptive. The ice might not be thick enough to carry a person's body weight, and the person could break through the ice and drown. And some people don't heed the warnings, and every year somebody goes on a frozen lake or pond anyway. Now, I got to tell you about my grandmother's cousin in Minnesota. And, of course, in Minnesota there are, 15,000 lakes, and the whole side of the family loved to go fishing. And this particular fellow, and as a kid I knew him, he's my grandmother's cousin, he would be fishing every day of the year on the lake if he possibly could. He, in the summer, spring, summer, and fall, he'd have his boat out there every day. He lived for that. And he couldn't wait for the lakes to freeze over. So when they froze over, he would have a little plywood shack that he could assemble to put this plywood enclosure, about a 4x4, and then put a drill a hole in the ice. They would put a little tiny stool over the, a little table over the hole that they drilled, throw their hooks and bait in the hole, and then they would sit, and he and a buddy would sit in their little ice house, and they would drink their favorite adult beverage and play cards until the fish bit on the line. And there are other stories about that were reserved for another time. Well, this particular fellow, at some point in the spring, the ice will melt. It'll start getting thinner. In fact, it will no longer become safe to drive in public. And indeed, the many places in Minnesota, and maybe other northern states, I don't know, they will hold a raffle. They will take an old car and park it in the middle of the lake when the lake is frozen. And then for a dollar, you can guess the day, the hour, and the minute that that car is going to go through the ice. And however many raffle tickets they sell, you get the money if you're the closest one to when it goes through the ice. Well, and if you want to guess lots of times, you pay more dollars for the raffle. Well, my grandfather's or grandmother's cousin, he would go ice fishing up until the last possible day. Now, he was a rather large fellow, and he walked with two canes. Not one, but two. And I remember as a kid, he needed both canes. He didn't get around well, but on the water, he could row. And he didn't have to do much walking in the ice house. He had bad knees, and so he was going to go out, and of course the family all knew about this right after it happened. He's driving out onto the lake to his little ice fishing house, and the four wheels of the car broke through the ice. Now, we learned early from this example, everybody open your car doors, and that'll slow the car from going into the ice. He didn't do that. He didn't open his car because it just takes a little bit. Once it goes through, he couldn't open the doors to the car. And so he was going down. And, of course, that was in the days before they had electric car windows. You had the little crank handles on the side. Nowadays, I suppose kids don't even know what those are. It's all electric windows. But the little crank handles. And so everybody in the family is still wondering how he managed to roll the windows down, get out of the vehicle before it sunk under the ice. And the others that rescued him said they looked out on the lake and it looked like a flopping walrus was out in the middle of the lake and there was no vehicle. Everything had gone through. There was a rectangular hole where the car had gone in. And, of course, he couldn't walk without canes and he couldn't walk anyway. And they couldn't drive out to rescue him, so a couple of guys went out with a sled and towed him in. Well, what was our lesson? It says, the lesson is, how do we know if we're on spiritual thin ice? At first glance, everything will look normal. It'll all look the same. But you can't tell from looking if a frozen lake is safe to drive. And so it's our individual responsibility to know the thickness of the spiritual ice. We have to know in our own minds and our hearts, the secure in the knowledge of God and what God expects of us. If you take someone else's word for it, are you going to go out on thin ice? Or are you going to say, you know what, I think we better drill and check, make sure how thick that ice is. Because our eternal life depends upon our discernment for the thickness of our spiritual ice. Basically, the question is, are we abiding by the doctrines of God or the commandments of men? We have an example in Acts 17, starting in verse 11. Actually, I'll start in verse 10. In Acts 17, here's Paul and Silas. They're coming from Thessalonica, and they're traveling to Berea. And we'll pick it up in Acts 17 and verse 11. And they're preaching then in Berea. And it tells us these, meaning the Bereans, were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind. Isn't that what every apostle wants when he's traveling? That people are willing to bring it. Yes, I want to hear more. Tell me the truth. But what does it continue on? They took it with all readiness of mind. They were hungry for the truth. It says, and they searched the scriptures daily whether these things were so. Did they just take somebody's word for it? They wanted to hear, but then they searched the scriptures. They went to the source. They went to God's word. They weren't going to allow themselves to be misled like the people in Thessalonica. So it's really quite simply, trust your Bible. Don't place those who would place, put your trust in those who took the place of the Pharisees or the Sadducees. And as we read in Mark 7:7, the commandments of men are not the commandments of God. So the warning number four is that Christ warned us, beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Warning number five, beware of the leaven of Herod. In Mark 8 and verse 15, in Mark 8, 15, he charged them saying, this is Jesus speaking, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Well, we talked earlier about the leaven of the Pharisees, and now it says the leaven of Herod. Well, Herod was a local ruler, a secular ruler, and so what do you mean the leaven of Herod? You know, he couldn't characterize him as a believer. But you see, Herod was in charge of administering the civil law, the Roman law, and he had to enforce it. But Herod didn't follow the moral law. He was personally immoral when it came to marriage and murder and other things. He followed the secular law under the Roman Empire. And so thus the leaven of Herod draws attention to what we would call the bifurcation of civil or Roman law and the moral law, meaning two different directions, two different branches. You're going to follow one or you're going to follow the other. And today we have people who consider themselves very upstanding if they haven't broken the law of the land, the civil law, but their morality, demonstrated morality, is unchristian. Now, that doesn't mean a person can't change and they express that they're not following God's law at one point in their life, but they're improving. But the leaven of Herod involves the exalting of civil law above God's moral law, putting man's law above God's law. And Jesus tells us this warning to be watchful of this. Now, there's a good reason to beware of it. The secularists are very offended at the breach of civil law, and they will bring down the force of law upon those who offend their law. It happens all the time. If you lie to the police, you can end up in prison. But secular lies are about breaking secular laws are very selective. You see, you can't lie to the police, but the Supreme Court has said the police can lie to you. Ooh, well, that's uncomfortable to know. They can tell you any story they want to see if you'll admit to anything that they can catch you on. So the difference here is beware of the leaven of Herod, of following the civil law, putting it at a higher plane than God's law. And it's leaven because It makes you puffed up. Well, I'm a law-abiding citizen, just like Herod thought he was, but in fact, he didn't follow God's law. In fact, John the Baptizer really gave him the what for, as for the list of his sins, and let him know how he was breaching God's law. So, number five, the warning is beware of the leaven of Herod. Warning number six is beware of the scribes. Well, what kind of deal is that? Scribes are just people that write stuff down, right? In Mark 12, verses 38 through 40, beware of the scribes. He then said to them in his teaching, beware of the scribes who desire to go around in long robes, have greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at feasts, who devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. These are people, the scribes, put themselves above all the rest of us. While they're somebody, they do all of these important things, and so they're really important, so they'll have the best seatings, long robes, in other words, signifying a status of some sort. The best seats in the synagogue. Oh, that seat's reserved for so-and-so because they have special status. It says, interesting, devours widows' houses. I suspect what they're referring to here was the support of the widows. They're living off of it instead of allowing the widows the portion that was designated for them. Or pretense making long prayers. I grew up in a Protestant church, and as a kid, my dad said that he was tasked with giving the prayer the next week. And I remember saying, well, Dad, whatever you do, don't give a prayer like Pastor Kotke that goes on and on and on. My dad said that drove him to such distraction that he probably had a record short prayer that came the following week. Because that obviously became noticeable. They wanted to be known for their long prayers. Why? The longer the prayer, the more righteous they are. Isn't that how it works? Beware of the scribes, as it says. In Matthew 23, there's a whole list of the that lists scribes, Pharisees, issues here. In Matthew 23:13, Jesus calls them hypocrites. We heard that one before. Says, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow others who are entering to go in. So they're not respecting the gospel, not respecting the law of God. Verse 14, he says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, again, hypocrites. And he goes on, verse 15, you travel land and sea to win one proselyte. When he's won, you make him twice as much as the son of the grave as yourselves. In other words, you're not lifting him up, you're bringing him down. Verse 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. What are they doing? Nitpicking out the little things to give an appearance of righteousness, but they're leaving the big things, as they say, undone. Verse 24, blind guides who strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. You know those little fruit flies that come in sometimes and you buy some fruit and pretty soon you got fruit flies in the house that isn't consumed right away? Very annoying. So you think, well, how would you strain at a gnat, those tiny little things, and then swallow a camel? That's really a message for another time because a camel's kind of big. And you think that's the obvious. But they're looking on the little things rather than focusing on the big things. And verse 25, cleansing the outside of the cup and the dish, but the inside are full of extortion and self-indulgence. He says, first clean the inside of the cup, that the outside may also be clean. And it goes on to verse 27. Whitewashed tombs, which appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and uncleanness. So outward it all looks good. And that's what they want to do. They have virtue signaling. We're virtuous, we're specially righteous, but inside the heart, it's not so. And it goes on throughout this chapter, ending with verse 36. All these things will come upon this generation. Well, that was 2,000 years ago, okay? And it's gone on generation after generation. So warning number six, beware of the scribes. They have earned special warnings and condemnations. Warning number seven is beware of covetousness. In Luke 12 and verse 15, and he, Jesus, said to them, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist of the abundance of the things he possesses. Well, we don't have too many millionaires and billionaires sitting with us today. And so I think most of us are not really tied up with our physical possessions. But we could be. It could be that we put the possessions in front of our relationships with other people. And when we do that, we're putting other things in the place of God and our other relationships. If that was Luke 12, 15. If we take a look then at Colossians 3, 5. In Colossians 3, 5, therefore put to death your members which are on earth. In other words, stop doing these things. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Now, we think of worshiping idols as really bad. I mean, there are throughout history, and even today, there are many cases where people have worshiped idols and continue to worship idols. And we could maybe go through this at some point in another message. But how many of us think about covetousness where we want something that somebody else has? We have entire economic systems that are built on covetousness. You have it and I don't, therefore I deserve it because I don't have that. And we should build our tax system around it. In fact, sometime I'll probably do that message on economic systems as to how the economic systems in the Bible are consistent with the Ten Commandments and how this beware of covetousness, how it violates many of the Ten Commandments. Now, when it says beware of covetousness, meaning wanting something that somebody else have, we've probably all seen a sign that says beware of dog. So what do we think of when we see the sign beware of dog? I mean, what comes to mind? Perhaps some big mean dog that's likely going to bite us, chew a chunk of our flesh. And most of us will probably have a ferocious dog story that we can tell each other where we were attacked or threatened by a dog. Mine started early in life. And you know, when I was a kid, I heard about junkyard dogs. What do they need a junkyard dog? Until I realized the junkyard dogs are guard dogs protecting all of these auto recyclers. The guy goes home at night, go to sleep, he's got the dog in this huge automotive recycling place. And so people want to come in and steal car parts, they got to deal with the dog. And then there's a sign that says, don't worry about the vicious dog, instead worry about the owner. That would make a person even more nervous. The message is clear. Don't trespass. There's going to be unpleasant consequences. So you can take your pick. Do you want to deal with the vicious dog or the angry owner or maybe both? Now, I live in a suburb of Fayetteville, Arkansas, and it's one of the top 10 of the least crime-ridden cities in the entire state of Arkansas. I haven't looked in Missouri to see that list. Two of the top 10, one is where we meet for services and the other one is where I live. Just kind of nice it turned out that way. Well, why is that? Well, I found out 90% of the people in town have a gun or a dog or both. Very discouraging for those who are covetous that want to bother to get things from other people. Well, covetousness is idolatry. A lot of references to that in the Bible. We're to beware of that. We don't put things or other people's things in our eyesight. Now, it's not wrong to want something, but it is wrong to sin in order to get something that belongs to someone else. Well, the warnings by Jesus, are they any less important than the warnings about icy roads or avoiding vicious dogs, maybe stopping at flashing railroad lights, or maybe the reports of thin ice, or the warning about putting on our caps or gloves in cold weather, or maybe the car warning lights about the low oil, or maybe the fluid temperature is too high, maybe the warning about wearing our overshoes in muddy weather, or maybe a warning about operating heavy equipment. Each of the warnings exist for our benefit. But even more important than those physical warnings are the spiritual warnings. And if we look at those, these specific seven warnings were given by Jesus. Beware of false prophets. How many of them? They use the term many. And how many will be deceived? Many. We don't want to be among those many. Beware of men. The trickery of men. People can deceive you. Beware of number three. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. This is putting things that puff them up that can grow and replacing the law of God with the commandments of men. The same thing with number four. The doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Not replacing the commandments of God with people, with stuff that people make up. Warning number five, beware of the leaven of Herod. Don't let the secular law outrank the moral law. Maintain the moral law. Beware of the scribes. Don't put some people higher than others. We're all volunteers in the service of God. And we should all treat each other accordingly, that we are fellow servants for God. And number seven, beware of covetousness, because we don't want that idolatry to displace our relationship with God and sacrifice our place in the future family of God. Well, seven times Jesus entered the warnings, and he followed it with an explanation as to what we should be aware of. And it was important for the Creator and Messiah to mention it. It's important for us to understand what he was warning us about. A sign warning us of danger walking on thin ice, so we should be mindful of the warnings issued by Jesus.